Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another in our ongoing series, the Sunday Afternoon Murder Club, a chance to talk about cases old and new. As always, I'm joined in the studio by my very lovely wife, Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Simon. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, I've buttered her up, so now I can... now, yeah. well, I'll just move right along. From the wilds of Los Angeles, we have veteran trial attorney Manny Barling. Manny, welcome.
Well, hello, everyone. I missed everybody for a week, and I hope you all came back.
Well, we missed you so much that we opted to not even put the program on.
I bet you tell that to all the guys.
From upper New York State, we have the crime doctor himself, Denny Griffin. Denny, welcome.
Good afternoon, Simon and all. Glad to be back with you.
I trust that Hurricane Irene did not impact you too badly.
It could have been a lot worse. We got some rain and a little wind, but no major damage, thankfully.
Yeah, here in Mississippi, we're enjoying the fruits of Tropical Storm Lee. I was a bit concerned. And I was even more concerned when I went down to Walmart and discovered that they had completely sold out of flippers and snorkels.
Lots of water.
Jan,
so, Simon, did Jan tell you this was coming when you moved to the Deep South?
She did. Actually, this morning, though, was the icing on the cake. She was a little bit PO'd because the satellite was out. And she suggested that I climb on the roof and hold an umbrella over it.
It was the end of the movie, and it was the best part, and they cut it off.
That's horrible.
Yeah, I declined the offer. You know, in fact, I just gave her that look. Are you nuts? From Orlando, Florida, we're joined by journalist and good friend Dave Knackle. Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Simon, and hello to everyone else. It's a great Sunday, day before Labor Day.
Right.
So is everybody done with their Labor Day shopping?
I've bought all of my maternity wear. And last but by no means least, we have bail bondsman and general troublemaker William Cobra Storbs with us. Cobra, how are you today?
It's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day. Good to hear everybody. Didn't you forget something, girl? We got a girl out there too, don't we?
Who's running the show, Cobra?
Well, you said least but not last, or last but not least, but you forgot one.
Yeah, but you're last but not least,
okay.
General Troublemaker.
Oh, okay.
As always, our chat room is open, and we do invite listeners to ask their questions. We also do ask that you be nice to each other. This week, we want to explore a cold case. It was 22 years ago that a young lady, Caitlin Arquette, was killed. Actually, I'll change that statement. In my opinion, she was executed.
Lord.
Denny, you've been following this case, and I believe that today you've brought along a secret weapon. Would you like to tell us a little about the case and introduce our special guest.
Sure thing, Mr. Simon. On July 16th of 1989, approximately 11 p.m., a young lady, 18-year-old Caitlin Arquette, was operating her vehicle in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And at that point, she was shot in the head. Her car ran into a pole, jumped the curb, ran into a pole. And the police treated the shooting as a random drive-by shooting. And they ended up assuming or going after four Hispanic suspects for the shooting. But from there, everything turns bizarre, at least in my opinion. The crime scene or the scene of the initial incident, which was reported as a non-injury automobile accident, everything is bizarre about who was at the scene, when they got there, what they did when they got there, interviews that apparently weren't conducted that should have been. It's just a very bizarre thing. And your guest on the show today is Albuquerque private investigator Patricia, I call her Pat, Caristo. And Pat has been involved in this investigation for several years. And if I may say, Pat is also one of our consultants on the Crime Wire show. And Pat has done, I think, a tremendous job of piecing this thing together and putting together a timeline of what went down and who was where and when, and raising the questions that were, have not been answered to this point. So I hope Pat will be able to bring us all up to date on where this case stands and where her investigation stands.
Actually, Pat, welcome to the program. I think a good starting point, because many of our listeners know nothing about this case, is can you give us a quick overview? What happened and why? Oh, that's a tough one.
You gave me the hard question right off the bat. Thank you for having me. I'm enjoying hearing all your people. Where is Mr. William Cobra Staubs from? I didn't hear that part.
It's okay. You should be relatively safe.
just say it's very warm where he lives.
All right, fine.
One well, can say it any way they like.
It's Fort Lauderdale,
Florida. Well, I thought it was interesting that that on a Sunday afternoon we are in so many different states of the union discussing this case, and apparently you do this frequently. I find it interesting. You ask me why. I can't tell you why. I can surmise, and going back to your comment about it being an execution, it seems to me that Kate was deliberately targeted. We believe it was because she was talking, quote-unquote talking, about some things that would have gotten people in trouble. I think she had no idea what she was saying when she told people, I'm going to tell about this. I don't want to be involved. You people are doing the wrong thing. I'm going to tell. I think she thought it was something between her and the Vietnamese boyfriend that she was loved and with whom she had been associating for about a year. He had involved her in some criminal behavior, and she had been telling people that she didn't like what was going on. I think, and indicators seem to show, that the what she was involved in or what she knew was going on was a tip of the iceberg, and those activities were being protected. Had she come forth about that part of it, it would have then opened up a can of worms, and she had to be silenced. Was she deliberately shot at to kill her, or whether the two shots ended up killing her was the result of not necessarily a murder? We still don't know the answers. And part of the problem is, to this day, We do not know what happened at the crime scene, and that's the problem.
Manny, you live in California, and you're a pretty sharp character. Insurance scams are not unknown in the state. Basically you ram a car, and everyone makes a huge claim against the insurance companies. Is it as common as I'm led to believe?
Not anymore. When you look at the time period that we're discussing, though, there were several Vietnamese gangs and other people doing it. In fact, my son was involved with one of them. They're called Stop and Squats because they basically stop, you know, it's called, technically the term is stealing the margin of safety, where someone jumps, pulls their car in front of you, slams their foot on the brakes, and you can't stop but hit them, and then you claim that this person rear-ended you. Well, somewhere about this time in the late 80s, insurance companies gave a grant to the state of California, and they joined a joint team together, the state, the AG, state police, local authorities, and they sought to clamp down on these. And in my son's case, as a lawyer, my son's a lawyer also, he immediately reported it to the police, and they were arrested, and they followed up on it, and eventually they were convicted of that type of scheme. But anyway, to make a long story short, we at the same time, we had another incident that really started it, where two guys on the what's called the 5 freeway out here, the Golden State Freeway, very close to Dodger Stadium, performed the same thing in front of a truck, thinking they were going to make a bundle of money off of a crash with a truck, and guess what? They all got killed because the truck just couldn't stop quick enough to keep them from dying. So apparently there is some justice in this world. So over a period of time, they did a nice job of cleaning it up. And as mentioned in some of your innuendos and the various things I read, there was a problem with the police. Several police were thought to be involved. Some were prosecuted. Others were run out because they couldn't prove it. And that has been, over a period of time, a deep concern for so many people, is that this attracted that bad element of the police department. So there's a lot of danger here. The Vietnam community in the Orange County area, generally Westminster in that area, which borders on L.A. County, has one of the highest concentrates of Vietnamese other than probably South Texas. And even then, I think we have more here. And so at the end of the day, controlling gangs of any foreign group, not unlike the mafia in its day, basically foreigners come to the United States, they're subject to the difficulties with gangs because, like a lot of people in the lower economic bracket, they cannot afford the type. They're afraid of police. They don't speak the language well. And, you know, it's the same basic formula that allowed the mafia to rise during the 20s. So, and, of course, they always claim that protecting the people from their foreign country and protection, as we all know, is one of the things that's most frequently sold under these circumstances. So I hope this helps everybody get a general background of what was going on in California at the time.
Okay, I think we might have Peter Hyatt on the line as well.
Hey, good afternoon, Simon.
Well, hello, Peter. Peter, hang tough. I will come right back to you. Pat, you've just listened to Manny talk about the Vietnamese gang problem in Los Angeles. I doubt that what he said came as a huge surprise, but very few people understand just how insidious the Vietnamese gangs are. Did you explore the California connection extensively?
Oh, absolutely. And interestingly, I believe it was the same task force that Mr. Darling was talking about. We did have interaction.
His name is Manny. If you call him Mr., he'll get a big head.
we did interact with them. We exchanged some information. They verified that what these identified young men, associates of Caitlin's boyfriend and his associates, were identified as being involved in multiple car accidents out in California. One resulted in a death, actually, and they were also involved in some arson for profit. They were involved in some drug trafficking, computer trafficking in stolen computer chips. It was an organized criminal activity. And just a month or so before she was killed, Kate took a trip out to California with a boyfriend, another one of the friends from New Mexico, who happened to be the cousin of the paralegal who was the organizer of this particular group. While there, she met the paralegal. She became aware of maybe more things than she should have known. Her boyfriend was paid at least two checks, $1,500 checks. Those checks went through Caitlin's checking account. However, the Albuquerque Police Department did not see this as a valid motive for looking at the Vietnamese subjects. They did not. The department, interestingly enough, I'm trying to not go too far afield, but to stay on the subject. The investigator who was assigned to Caitlin's case was not assigned to follow up on the California aspect. That was given to another investigator. That investigator dealt with Westminster Police. They exchanged some information, but none of that information got put into Caitlin's case. And the case investigator said that wasn't made available to him. It seems that there was an effort to compartmentalize the information in Caitlin's case so that the key investigator was never made aware of what the full ramifications of all of this was. And in fact, interestingly, he interviewed the boyfriend, asked him some questions about this staged auto accident, allegations that were being made in the media. He lied to them and said no, he had nothing to do with it, it wasn't going on. And in fact, they were actively recruiting students at the University of New Mexico to participate in these activities. Nonetheless, at what point the boyfriend went in to see the same detective, admitted that he had lied, that he had been told by the paralegal in California not to tell the truth. Well, you would think that that would mean the detectives would then re-look at the Vietnamese subjects. No. They said that, well, that information came after the case was over, after they had arrested four Hispanic males. The complaint on those was a tip to Crime Stoppers, and that could open a whole nother program, but those four Hispanic young men had nothing to do with this. The tips were made to divert the attention from the Vietnamese as suspects. And that's a long answer, and I'm not sure that I made as much sense as I need to make.
And by the way, on this show, you can drift any way you want.
Right. Dave, I know that you haven't spent a great deal of time looking at this case, but what do you think so far?
Well, it sounds to me like the police were in, you know, it's like a lot of city police departments, they get involved in payola, you know, and I think it sounds a little bit like this was the same thing, that some of the cops were getting paid to look the other way, and consequently they swept this under the carpet, this investigation.
I kind of disagree, but I'm going to come back to that. Peter Hyatt, you spend a lot of time looking at the written word, and I know that you've poked around in this particular case. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say hello to Pat, and I know you've done a great deal of work, and I admire how much effort you've put into this over the years.
Thank you.
It's nice to talk to you. I had originally gone through I can't say read, but have gone through Lois's book. I'm actually currently reading it now without analytical lenses, just reading it for itself. But originally, on some of the analysis I had looked at, I had felt that there was a possibility that the Vietnamese gang had intimidated one of the local officers assigned to this case. This was just a speculation on my part, but a concern that there has to be a reason why follow-ups weren't made. And I had wondered and quoted this, that the roommate knew more than she was letting on, or the friend, and that perhaps a young police officer, even with a family, may have felt some form of intimidation by a gang. It certainly wouldn't be unheard of.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. I want to go back to the Paola aspect. I'm not sure I buy into the Paola idea. What I think happened was that it was an investigation that probably started with good intentions and just spiraled out of control. Suddenly, problems were, compounding on other problems, and it was almost a race just to find a way to mark the case closed.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hispanics seemed to be the favorite victim. Any comments on that? Anyone?
I'd love to jump into there because I commonly comment on the show about that police are too much in a hurry to close files and look for excuses, and I constantly bring up the subject of the annual FBI crime reports and everybody's
mm-hmm.
need to, get lower down on the proverbial list. And then this is one of these typical cases where they can look around and go, oh, my God, this involves gangs and stuff. That's a big city problem. It's not our problem. And they look for a way to get rid of the case. And in this case, they were given an opportunity, and they don't want to reopen the case because they reopen the case, and, of course, that case becomes active in their statistical analysis. And the last thing they want to do is open up a cold case that requires some statistical participation from somebody. So, and also, a lot of these smaller police departments aren't as capable as the large departments. And I hate to steal a line out of Dante's Inferno, but those who can't, don't want to serve in heaven, would rather reign in hell. And so a lot of guys who can't get a work in the big city police departments end up in these small departments where they're quick to get rid of cases, don't want to put the effort out, don't want to deal with gangs or anything else because, gee, why else would you move to a beautiful state like New Mexico but to avoid all these big city problems that we're now talking about? And certainly a gang murder would be one of those. So, they just don't have the stomach for it, frankly.
That's a great point. It puts
Can I ask something about this? I mean, on the katearquette.arquettes.com website, four activities are listed. One is Asian crime in New Mexico and California. Certainly this goes above and beyond the local police. Drug smuggling, again, above and beyond the local police. Drug activities involving New Mexico VIPs. And the last one is police corruption. So, I mean, this is what made me think that there's police corruption involved. I mean, they just looked the other way. They swept it under the rug. They didn't really do anything with it.
Can I jump in a moment? You were all
sure.
saying exactly right things about different parts of the case. And corruption occurs when one person, one police officer, and my background is law enforcement, I think that when I was on duty, I was a better person on duty because I respected the job I had to do and I respected the departments that I worked for. So I have a proclivity for seeing police officers as good, valid people. And in my efforts to do this private investigation, it was not my intention to solve this. It was to give information to the police so that law enforcement could solve this case, because they should solve it. Caitlin was a citizen of Albuquerque. Therefore, she deserved the treatment that a police department gives to its citizens. She was killed. They are obligated to find out who killed her so that these people wouldn't be killing other people. Basic justice.
Amen.
And if there's nothing else, she was entitled to that justice. The fact that they do not want to solve this case because it will implicate them in two or three different things that I can go into. Now they've shortchanged not only one victim, but all of the people in the city of Albuquerque. Corruption, I believe what happened here is there was something going on at the scene. Somebody came onto it by accident, inadvertently. It then had to be monitored, adjusted, manipulated. They let a man standing next to the victim's car leave the scene without ever being interviewed, questioned. At the time he was there, he was a perfect candidate to be a legitimate suspect. He still, to this point, has never been interviewed, even though all of this information was provided to the police by multiple people. When Caitlin was killed, it was at a time that Albuquerque Police Department was being embarrassed by the arrest of one of their police officers as the quote-unquote ninja bandit. He was robbing banks. An active Albuquerque Police Department officer robbing banks and killing people because those people were getting in his way of the bank robberies. The Vietnamese were said to be partly involved, maybe stealing cars for him. That's never been clarified, but they hung out at a location where lots of police officers hung out after hours. Caitlin was shot around the corner from this location. Matt Griffin, the ninja bandit, is on the news the night of Kate's murder. He's on the news for being indicted. The police knew that there would have been, in my opinion, the police knew that this would have led them to the location where Matt Griffin and the, one of the people he killed hung out, and this would have opened up a more of a big investigation than they wanted to deal with. So they let this case go thinking no one would pay any attention to it. It was a random drive-by shooting. How very sad. And in fact, an interesting piece of information, one of the men, police officers, who was at the scene without being dispatched, without having an official role, seems to have directed the criminalistics unit's activities. That same person provided six motorcycle escort for Kate's funeral. The newspaper article talks about it being an unprecedented escort, six motorcycles for a young 18-year-old girl killed in a drive-by shooting. But this same officer wanted to show the department cared. And a couple of years later, this same officer, sergeant, is arrested for burglary and other criminal behaviors, and it goes round and round. So the corruption, and I add one thing, the corruption is not by the criminalistics unit. They arrived, they trusted the person giving them information, and they proceeded with what they thought was a good point to proceed. They don't know that they were corrupted.
Denny, I want to bring you in on the conversation. We've talked several times about your CrimeWire endeavors, and as you like to point out, the only cases that CrimeWire will look at have to have a solvability aspect. You know, that there's lots of cold cases Unfortunately, many of those cold cases will forever remain cold. There's a solvability aspect with this case. There is a solution, an answer to what happened to Caitlin Arquette. Where did the system go wrong?
Well, as I mentioned, Simon, earlier, I think, and I think Pat also said this, the scene, the whole scene, it was bizarre. I mean, I in fact, was reading Pat's outline or synopsis earlier today again, and it just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's like you got two different versions. The ambulance and fire people saw one thing or failed to see certain things that the police saw or stated were going on. And obviously they both can't be right. You had various units from these agencies that were supposedly all at the scene about the same time, yet the scene was different from both versions. And mm-hmm. It's very odd. Pat, am I right on that? I mean, it's very confusing because they both can't be right. Either there were police units on the scene or there weren't. Either there were medical personnel on the scene or there weren't. Either this the guy you said who was on the scene who would have made a great suspect, either he was there or he wasn't. And it's very confusing, at least to me, to try to figure out what actually did happen at that scene. So I think right from square one, it got off to the wrong foot there. There's something wrong, in my opinion, about this whole initial response.
You're exactly right, and that has always been part of the problem. We've asked multiple people to look at this, and they do look at the case. They get the homicide investigative report. It seems okay. And they say, well, it seems okay to me. What they don't get are the first three, four, five reports from the scene, and that's where all the problems are. And the police, for example, reword certain things so that you don't look in the right direction. Now, is that, for example, a place that is considered to be an after-hours police hangout, where there's insurance fraud, where there is a chop shop operation, where people who are killed by police officers also hung out at the same location, the address in the police report is recalled a dirt lot. And when I went to the scene, I expected to see a dirt lot. It was a business. It was an address. It was a company. They did not want you to look at that location. The same thing when they write in the report about a Volkswagen bug. They refer to it in the official reports as a small car. Even though police newspaper headlines, everybody is looking for information about a Volkswagen bug, please call in. They write the report as a small car.
Fishy there.
Right, and a witness in the field notes tells the officer, the investigating officer, he saw Caitlin leave her apartment between 5:30 and 6 p.m., and she was followed by a Volkswagen bug. Well, a critical piece of information, yet that never makes it into the homicide report. And when I asked the detective, he said, that guy was full of crap. Yet,
I have a question for Pat.
Sure.
Pat, has there been any progress in locating her friend? Because I had, Simon, I had asked Cobra at one point to also help look into it. We were trying to locate her to see if she would be willing, after all these years, perhaps, to be interviewed, because I strongly feel, at least.
The last person to see her alive?
Yes.
See, she's listed as Caitlin's friend. I'm not sure that that's a correct identification
that
of her.
Sharon?
Sharon. This person is not been truthful. She has not been forthcoming. I have reason to believe she may be even in a protected status by federal law enforcement.
Okay, because I knew that she hadn't been located. I had tried, and I'd asked Cobra to try for a while as well, and I wondered if there was any update on that, and I hadn't heard from Lois, so I assumed not.
I think I have found her most recent address, but she will not talk to me. In fact, the last contact she had with the Arquette family is if anybody tries to contact her, she would sue.
Yeah, she has a reason not to be contacted, and I,
yes.
I had hoped that the years would have softened this. So
no, I don't think so.
I apologize for having to cut off, but I will be tuning in next week and listening to the show, and greetings to everyone, and thank you for putting me on there, Simon.
Oh, no problem, Peter. Always delightful to have you on the program.
Hey, Simon?
Yes.
Simon? Can I, just talking about this this friend or so-called friend of Kate's, the last one known to have seen her alive, there's some discrepancy there, but in the timeline about what this lady had to say, she originally stated that Caitlin arrived at her apartment about 9:30 p.m. on the night of the shooting.
Oh,
she
God,
later,
you're reading my script again.
Okay. ESP. She later says that the police got that wrong. She tells Caitlin's family that Kay actually got there at her apartment at 7:30 p.m. after having attended a 5 p.m. movie. Yet we have Kate was actually at her parents' house until 6:15 p.m. that night. So that obviously Caitlin was not at a 5 p.m. movie. And this other fellow that Pat just mentioned saw Kate leaving around 6 p.m.-ish and followed by a Volkswagen Bug. So, you know, where was Kate then for that time period from around 6:15 or 6:30 until 9:30 when she gets to this so-called friend's house? I mean, there's a gap, and if this witness was accurate and she was, in fact, being followed by this VW Bug, and the VW Bug shows up at the scene of the shooting, you know, you got to wonder what was going on there and you know, question what was going on during this 2 or 3 hour gap.
Manny, I'm going to ask you. You're the analytical guy. You're the legal guy. When you get so many different versions of the truth, how do you figure out what's real?
Well, the question is how long and how successfully can people obviate the truth? In the case of the police, they can do it a long, long time. We ran into this in Los Angeles with the famous, Rampart Division scandal, where we had police not only dealing with drugs, but helping participate in robberies. And in some case, one of the cops' wives knew he was doing it, but couldn't stop him from doing it, but they couldn't turn him in. So, you know, to me, there was a story. I once had a study hall my freshman year at USC, and John McKay, the former football coach, taught it, and someone was saying to him, God, you do such a great job of changing people. And he, you know, he looked at us and he puffed on his cigar and he said, you know, and I've never forgotten it all my life, he said, playground directors, teachers, and parents make men out of people. When I get them, all I can do is coach them. It's just too late. Well, they've lowered the standards in the police department throughout the years. In some areas, police have a harder time hiring people, so the tests aren't as demanding as they were once in my childhood when my brother's best friend didn't qualify for the police department, couldn't pass the psychological, and we always wondered why. And although I've never seen anything in the adult years to see otherwise, but the test was very, very restrictive. Well, it's not anymore. So what we have are lesser quality policemen with lesser levels of morality. They're also underpaid and at times deeply resentful for it, especially in the drug arena where they see all these gangs earning all this money. And, you know, those people involved around law enforcement know what I'm talking about. And you know, you see it every night on the TV show, for God's sake. But there's some truth to all of this. So at the end of the day, we don't look at police departments the way we once did. We look at them somewhat with a jaundiced eye, and this is a police department that's earned that statement. There's something wrong in New Mexico. There's something wrong with this case. And no matter what you say or do, you can't get around it. So as a lawyer, you know, my wife jokes because sometimes I'll tell her something, and sometimes, Simon, even you and I discuss it. And she'll say, how do you know this? And I'll say, well, for lawyers, it's like looking at an X-ray. And for Denny and others listening to the show, including Pat, to them it's like looking at an X-ray, too. And you just sort of know it when you see it and smell it. And I think that's Pat's problem with this, is no matter how hard she's worked to preserve the sanctity of police force that she loved for so long, it doesn't look right or smell right to it. And in simple words, this case doesn't pass the smell test.
Pat, obviously you need to respond.
It's very interesting. As an investigator, we're supposed to be objective, and I do try to be objective as best I can. When I got involved in Caitlin's case, it was really in a very simple, basic approach to try to get a copy of the incident report. That was my initial assignment for an attorney that I was doing some work for. Caitlin's case was called a random drive-by shooting. This attorney had an insurance aspect of his case that if in random drive-by shootings, because the shooter is unidentified, your uninsured motorist part of your insurance policy would cover, and the family could recover some monetary that could be reimbursed, that kind of thing. The attorney asked me to find the police report because all he needed to have was the police report to say that the shots that killed Caitlin were fired from a moving vehicle. That started a case that is still all these years unsolved. I went down to the police department. They said I could not have the incident report because the case was under investigation, and I couldn't have it. I went back to the attorney, and the attorney said, I need the report. Go back down. I went back, talked to the supervisor of records, and I said, look, I don't need anything. I just need the statement that said the shots that killed Caitlin were fired by a moving vehicle. So the supervisor of records said, I will look through all the reports, and I will give you that statement. She went through all of the reports, and there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of report. And she said, nowhere in any of the reports, not the criminalistics report, not the investigative report, that says the shots were fired from a moving vehicle. I went back to the attorney, and he said, I need that information. Never be understanding that this was going to open up this can of worms. We finally did get a copy of the police reports, and it is correct. Nowhere was there an accident reconstruction, an accident investigation, a path of travel. None of that was done. So the attorney said to me, I need this done. You go do an accident reconstruction. I'm not a reconstructionist, but I know how to do the preliminaries. So I went and took photographs, measurements. We submitted the report to a reconstructionist who said that the cars were either moving side by side at the same rate of speed or this and X, Y, and Z happened. That's how we started. And it turned out that the Arquette family would have had to sue the insurance company for this process to go through. The family didn't want to do that because they did not want to be perceived as filing a lawsuit to benefit on the death of their daughter. So they dropped it. I then picked this case up as a teaching case because I found a report that talked about the man being found at the scene. He was identified by name, 21-year-old Spanish male, address unknown, and a telephone number. So I said to my student investigators, that was at least a witness. Let's see if we can find him. Not to really find him, but to do the process. And that's where this case started. We found him. How come the Albuquerque Police Department couldn't find him? Ultimately, when we gave the information to the police department, and the investigator agreed to meet with me at a restaurant, not at the police department, but at a restaurant, and said that they would listen to the information about the man at the scene, but I was not permitted at all to give them any information about the Vietnamese. They would not listen to any of that information. I gave them the information about the man at the scene. When he was standing next to this car, had already had 9 contacts with police for unprovoked attacks against women in the university area where Kate frequented and some other things, and weeks before had been arrested for shooting a .22 caliber weapon and drinking from Budweiser beer cans. Well, that seems unnecessary piece of information, except that the criminalistics took from the Caitlin Arquette crime scene red and white cans of Budweiser beer and placed it into evidence. But they never would look at this man found at the scene. Finally, in 2005, a cold case detective agreed to look at the case again, and he said, "This isn't right, this isn't right. Let's talk to the first officer at the scene." The first officer at the scene said, "I'll come in and talk as long as everybody else is sitting around the table." We were setting that up. They agreed to interview the man at the crime scene who was in prison for some other crimes similar to Caitlin's case. And then all of a sudden, a witness resurfaced back from the Crime Stopper tips on the Hispanics. One of the witnesses resurfaced that satisfied APD that the Hispanics were, in fact, the shooters. Therefore, they didn't have to talk to the man at the scene, and the case was closed again, and that cold case detective is no longer in cold case.
Dave, doesn't this sound like a wonderful case to get involved in?
Yeah, it really does, you know, because everything looks bad. Everything looks corrupted. Everything looks tainted. And you know, it really does look like something that's well worth researching. I mean, I when I started reading about it, I was immediately drawn into it. So, yeah, it's something that's worth probably working on.
There are so many aspects that just don't add up.
Well, I have someone I want to ask, Simon. And, they didn't want to file a lawsuit maybe about the daughter and the insurance companies and all the rest, which is something the insurance companies play on all the time. But the simple fact is I haven't heard one explanation on why they didn't file a civil rights action, which would have forced the police department to either do something or open up their files. And, you know, I see, in fact, I've referred more than my share of people to various lawyers who specialize in it because it does happen. And I just wondered if there's any reason why they didn't do that.
I can answer that or attempt to answer it. First of all, by the time they... When Lois wrote the book, Who Killed My Daughter, I hadn't provided anyone, well, they weren't aware of the information I found about the problems with the scene. So they weren't aware of any of that, and by the time they became aware of that, then the statute of limitations for filing a wrongful death had told.
Well, I'm not they talking about a wrongful death now. We're talking about
civil
rights action.
Right. And so then they did begin to try to find attorneys who would handle a wrongful death case. They couldn't find any. We submitted the case to the FBI. The FBI said that they don't have a jurisdiction in murder, but they would look at the Vietnamese organized criminal activity. And they said they looked at it and then said, my job was to find the connection between the Vietnamese and the four Hispanics. I tried to explain to them that there would not be a connection because the Hispanics were falsely alleged on. At this point, we've attempted to get the U.S. attorney to look at this. We have gone to every jurisdiction that we can think of to go to. And I agree, it is a civil rights violation, but the family hasn't been able to find anyone willing to take this on.
Manny, I'm sure that you have sage words of wisdom for us.
About what? About the fact that the police departments can be crooked and that the fact our judicial system's decaying?
Is it too late for the Arquette family to take the civil rights route?
Well, it would depend on how long they've discovered the information we're just discussing, but more than likely that it has passed, because we're talking about a long time now,
yes. Mm-hmm.
20 years, and I presume that some of this information was discovered more than just 1 or 2 years ago. So, yes, I do think it's a problem. There was also issues I had about, you know, the releasing of information, of course, everybody in the media knows you can do by filing various actions. And I guess in some respects, the family seems very committed, but in other respects, they seem timid about the legal complications of addressing this case, which I understand. I mean, first of all, you have to write checks, and none of us like to write checks to lawyers. And, you know, you have to debate whether it's going to bring you the resolution you want. There are a lot of things that play into this, but the simple fact is, at some point, the police are able to snowball you until you put their feet to the fire, and the only way to put their feet to the fire is, in my opinion, is to file an action which embarrasses them, makes them accountable, and allows you an opportunity to look at things within the police department you wouldn't otherwise be able to look at. So at some point, it just doesn't seem to work without it.
It has been my recommendation that we go for an obstruction of justice against the police department. Is that a valid thought on my part?
Well, obstruction of justice would have to be brought by the federal government,
right,
under the whole discussion that I was just having about bringing a civil rights action. So,
right.
If one's untimely, the other is, because in this case, if it truly is murder, then I don't think there's going to be a statute of limitations on it, unless New Mexico has its own unique statute of limitations.
We do, actually. Kate's case falls outside the boundary of it, but there for a while, that was a consideration that it may have been a statute of limitations case. It's since been resolved that it's not. But New Mexico did have a weird 7-year period for problems.
Yeah, they some of these are very, very weird. There's no question about them. But anyway, yeah, at some point, the only way to press this action is to spend money in attorney's fees. And that's the sad part about it, is the police are able to buffalo, and so like major corporations do, buffalo American citizens by just making the cost of the legal system too high for them to obtain the level of justice they want. And this is why you see so often a rich parent that has this problem losing a child is able to receive a level of justice that exceeds what the average citizen is. So in this case, they're not going to get too much farther unless they're capable of spending some money to get the result they want. And that to me, is the saddest commentary on justice in the United States. And as long as I live, it'll disturb me as a lawyer and as a human being that justice is too often determined by the size of your checkbook.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. let's move right along.
Was what I said that disturbing?
No. Well, yes. I think you hit the nail on the head. Justice is about the checkbook. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. One of the items that you brought up was about access to information. Everyone refers to it as Freedom of Information Act. Pat, as I understand it, you didn't have a great deal of success with FOIA requests. Every time you put them in, you got a little bit more. Can you tell us something about that?
The family did put in a Freedom of Information request from the FBI because we had believed that there may have been a case involving Caitlin. It turned out they did get a volume of the copies. It was all redacted, but the majority of the information that was in the FBI reports were my reports. So it was a kind of a roundabout way of getting no information. But we did learn that the FBI did have a case caption called The State Against Deng Nguyen, the boyfriend's name. But it turned out that they had no sufficient information to follow through on it. Albuquerque Police Department reports, we believe we got the majority of them, but we don't know because there's no way of knowing. We kept asking for copies of scene photographs. I did not see a copy of the scene photographs for probably 7 years after the murder. We were told it was not available. I can't answer. I'm getting some feedback, and I don't want to be annoying on the radio.
Can
you hear me now? I was getting some feedback. When I finally saw a picture of the car with bullet holes in the car and in the window, it reignited all the questions about two police officers were at that scene. One was a detective, a sex crimes investigator. The other one was a field officer. Neither one of them identified those bullet holes in that car. Guess who identified them? A rescue personnel. They said, that's a bullet hole in that car. And
wow.
So we asked for more photographs. And they said, no, there weren't any more. And then we said, well, we think there might be. And then they found some more. And then the news carried a photograph of the car, the Caitlin's car in the impound yard, with an I-1 marker, impact 1 marker, on the bullet hole in the door frame. Well, we had never seen any of those photographs. Went back to APD. APD said, that was not their photograph. I must have put the I-1 marker on the car, and I assured them it wasn't. We had to get the TV show videographer to say, no, that was on the car when I videoed it at the impound. They still today deny that that was their I-1 marker on that car and that they never processed that car after the crime scene investigation that night. So they want to take no responsibility for anything in this case. Caitlin was supposedly shot twice in the brain. A medical investigator says she lost full control of herself, yet the car traveled 700 feet before it landed up against this pole. There's fresh damage to the left side of the rear fender, looking like a quote-unquote pit maneuver. The crime scene people said, oh, that was old damage because we find no debris at the scene, therefore that's old damage. I can get out of control in my
I know the answer to the rear damage question, because I'm sure one of the panel's going to ask. I spent about an hour this morning on the phone with Lois and Don, and that was not there. You know, Don had been out working on his vehicle, and he would have noticed it. So that damage had to have happened that day.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes. And yet when we try to present this information to the police department, they will not consider it.
Well, of course they won't consider it. They don't want to reopen the case. And, they, you know, sometimes in life you have to just forget about what people say to you and look at what they do and judge them. You know, the old story about judging people by what they do and not what they say. And if you look at this case, no matter what they say, it still takes you back to the same conclusion,
mm-hmm.
that they're covering up the case for one reason or another. And those reasons, by the way, could include not willing to ever admit that it's incompetence. In every major jurisdiction I've ever dealt with, they've had trouble with cold case units because a lot of guys felt embarrassed if a cold case unit discovered that they should have solved the case in the beginning, and they tend to obstruct and do a variety of other things. So some of this is a very culture that drives the police department, and that's one of the problems with all of these is their self-interest is such, and the I wouldn't call it a code of silence as much as a code of fear, and especially in these smaller places because, you know, when you look at the amount of votes necessary to get rid of a police chief or how quickly they can be, you know, eliminated, then I find they're more sensitive. So yeah, I must tell you, I've had trouble with every small town police department I've ever dealt with. And I would like to add something that everybody should think about. When you have these problems, one of the first places to search for information is the local newspaper because they do assign people to go up and record and do things because they never know when they might need them later. So if there are other newspapers in that particular area, you might go check and see what they have in their files because you might be very surprised that there are other photos out there. I found that a number of times in my career. I said to someone in the LA Times once, I'd really like to know what you have in terms of a photo of this. And he says, well, I don't have anything. And then the photographer worked for him was sitting there, turned around out of his chair, spun to me and said, oh, I have photos on all that stuff. They're the ones I turn in and the ones I keep for myself because nobody wants them from me. So this is a case where those may exist and nobody really knows it because nobody's had a reason to ask the right people. So that's a thought for you, too, and that's been my experience, especially in smaller jurisdictions. In a place like Los Angeles, there's so much going on that they can't always get out and do the things you'd wish they would do. But then a smaller jurisdiction, I would think you would likely find something somewhere.
You're absolutely right, and it was the Albuquerque Journal that gave us information that we had not been able to get in any other way, and the news media covering the crime scene that night, their video became available to us, and that's where we got some of the evidence. So you're absolutely right on.
Yeah, it's a common problem, isn't it? Is finding out who really has the information. And those people, by the way, I've always found it quite willing to share it. Did you find that? They were
sometimes.
Very helpful? Yeah.
Sometimes. And at one point, the newspaper was, the editor was reluctant to carry any more stories on this case because they had already carried so many of them.
Well, that's a different issue, and that's not an uncommon issue either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is a problem. You know, that old line, the news only holds the headline for 3 days, and after a while it becomes meaningless, and that's the problem these people have. They view everything. Everything in America now has a short attention span, including the police. They don't solve it in 2 weeks, move on to the next one. And that's part of the problem, too.
Jan and I followed a pretty horrific story. It was out of Northern California. It was clear that no one was telling the truth about it. And I got hold of a reporter and asked those, you know, ugly questions. So, what really happened? And there was a lot of umming and ahhing. And after about 3 days, we had another phone call, and it went along the lines of, we really don't want to talk about it, because this is a small community, and you have to understand that we have to live here. If we piss the police off, we're going to be in big trouble.
Now, you would expect that in a deep southern town or small town somewhere in a Midwestern state. Believe me, in Ohio, I would expect that in every town. But in California, were you willing to say which city it was?
It was just outside San Francisco.
That's what I thought, a little bit north?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Yeah, I don't have to guess. You know, California is, you know, there was a senator who every year entered a bill during my youth where he wanted to split California in half into two states because the southern half had so little to do with the common, the north side of the state. Well, I want you to know, when you leave San Francisco, by the time you get about 40 miles north, 50 miles north, and definitely by the time you get to Santa Rosa, which is 60 miles north, from there on, it gets pretty small townish. Everybody knows everybody. It's as gossipy as any small town anywhere in this country, and equally dangerous and difficult. And to get information of small towns, you need a pliers, a torture chamber, and maybe even waterboarding. That's how tough it is. And if you're
Manny.
Yeah.
Manny. I know a guy, he's retired now, but at one point he was a news director in Sacramento, and he basically said the exact same thing. He said it was the most cliquish place he'd ever lived in. If you weren't part of that clique, you just didn't connect with anybody.
Oh, yeah. One of my earlier cases, I was working for title companies on assignment, and they sent me to try a case involving an easement on a ranch off of what's called a lake up there, which is just above a clear lake, which is just above Napa. And would you believe that everybody there knew everybody, everybody knew the case, and the only guy being involved in this lawsuit was a guy who moved up from Orange County, which attaches to L.A. County, up there to own a ranch. And he had a road that basically the other people who lived there forever, which were the heirs to the Hearst, Jorgensen's Markets, and a few other very wealthy families, sued him, and they had so much political clout, I was threatened when I went up for trial. I had to have a bodyguard in a small town in Northern California. I was afraid someone was going to shoot me with a rifle one day. And that happens a lot to lawyers. You talk, the average lawyer handles these difficult cases, and he'll tell you he's had his life threatened at least a half a dozen times during his career. So I wouldn't be surprised if that isn't an issue that people face commonly, and not only the news, but in doing what you're doing as an investigator.
Benny, I want to bring you in. What is the way forward with this case? I know you love cold cases, and this one's more than 20 years old. It's ripe. It's ready to be picked. But we need a way forward.
Well, my thoughts are this. I understand that the Albuquerque Police Department, now not directly related to Caitlin's case, but there could be some tie-ins to it, is under investigation, I believe, by the feds for some things and about the number of officer-involved shootings and so forth. So I think Albuquerque PD is being looked at now. And if that's the case, you know how it is, you get these investigations going, all of a sudden people want to maybe make themselves valuable to the investigators or the prosecutors involved and so on. There may be some people willing to offer some information up if their careers are on the line or in jeopardy. So I think the timing from that aspect is probably good. It certainly doesn't hurt anything, I think, to have maybe the spotlight on these people. And I'd like to bring up something, Simon. Manny mentioned it a little bit ago in regard to the bringing an action against the PD to either force them to come up with all the records and so forth or embarrass them and that type of thing. And I'll tell you what I found, and I think that may fit in here, is a lot of these families, most of them, when they find themselves unexpectedly in this type of situation as the Arquettes found themselves in, with their daughter being killed, most of us trust the police. I mean, we think, hey, if there's where you go if you're in trouble. You go to the police department. They're going to help you out. They're going to take care of you. They're going to get you justice and all this kind of stuff. And I think in a lot of cases, by the time the light bulb comes on and the parents or the family of the victim says, wait a minute, something isn't quite right here. We're hearing that, you know, key players in this case were never interviewed, that the police, the detective in charge of the case isn't really doing anything. They're, you know, the file's just collecting dust. But by the time that notion gets through to them, a lot of the cases, I think, states that your wrongful death is 1 or 2 year statute. I mean, so you can have things going on where the people, their trust in the police and the system is such, they don't realize for a while that there may be a problem with how their case is being handled. I don't know if that's true or that's been my experience. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just the people I'm running into. But that seems to be a thing that we all want to trust the police. And I'm not saying they're crooked, but I think there is, in some cases, at least incompetence out there, and if not more than that. And when you run into those cases, the poor families, you know, they're blindly hoping that their police agency and prosecutors and so forth are going to do the right thing, and never enters their mind for a while that maybe that's not happening. And by the time it does, it might be too late. And the other thing is trying to keep the focus on the agency around the case. And if you get where a smaller venue, where the newspaper people, the media people in smaller venue, maybe for political reasons, or Simon, what you were saying, you know, we're in a small area, we don't want to tick off the cops or we're in big trouble, you almost have to then get an outside reporter or network or something involved to do that, because the local media doesn't want any part of it. Now, I don't know if I'm wrong there or not, but that's the way I see it.
I think you hit it right on the nail. I mean, it's sad but true.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that is one of the problems. And of course, the police are very deceptive. They're reassuring, so they have an agenda. It's even easier for them to cover up the agenda. But again, coming back to this, one of the things that might help too is, and Pat, I'll bet you've probably already done this. You've taken a look at the list to see which police officers retired from that period, and particularly ones who may not be willing to keep their mouth shut, because it's quite possible that there is somebody out there more willing to talk. Have you done that?
Yes. Well, Lois and Don maintain a website that I don't contribute to. As an investigator, I need to keep my information tighter than that comes in on websites.
Right.
Lois will give me information that comes in off the site, so I don't see everything. But that website is being fed by information that I can recognize our police officers. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to say that not all police officers are corrupt, not all police officers are incompetent, and most, I think, are doing the best jobs they can do under various circumstances. But yes, police officers are following this case and do make very good suggestions, and that's why still today we find new information daily. But interestingly, we've been told just the converse of that the case is so old, everybody has been gone from that police department, and so we should be able to go back to them again. So I looked at that with this new eye, and sure enough, in the newspaper there was a picture of a detective that was investigating a very big kind of crime going on here in Albuquerque. That investigator is one of the people that is from the suspect location that we are looking at for officers with unusual ties. That officer is in the cold case unit today.
Oh.
So I don't know who to go to. I also don't want to go to officers and put them in bad lights, because I can't offer them any kind of protection.
Well, eventually it always comes out anonymously. And again, they're always, listen, I have a great deal of faith in the police, but I don't have a great deal of faith in individual policemen who can be corrupted based upon their own personal problems, prejudices, and other things. So, you know, some of that old joke, some of my best friends are police officers, but truly in my case they are. My closest friends, the just retired lieutenant in the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And I hear about this all day. And they spend, they literally, that's why you have internal affairs in major cities, mm-hmm. is to avoid these type of problems, because basically everyone in the industry readily admits that young police officers are vulnerable to some of these issues. So, yeah, there will be somebody, and it always comes from a place you least expect it. So
exactly.
I would keep your hopes up. It's there. It'll come out. What is the interesting way forward?
You know, where do you go from here?
People still love this 18-year-old girl. For some reason, when people in Albuquerque and actually because I guess of Lois's book, people all over the country, but certainly in Albuquerque, people still go to her gravesite on the anniversary dates and put flowers there. People still feel they know this girl. She's become a symbol for all the other young cases, young people whose cases are unsolved. So people would like to see Kate's case solved because it means their cases might be solved too. It is amazing what this young girl in her death has accomplished. It changed the way I do business. When I was first involved in Kate's case, I was a for-profit investigations agency. Working on Kate's case, I got involved with New Mexico Survivors of Homicide. And then the majority of what I do is unsolved homicides at no charge to the families. Many of those cases are underwritten by the Arquette family donations. So now 40 to 50 cases have been worked on because this one girl was killed. It is an amazing phenomenon, and now I work totally differently because I think I know this young woman. And the city of Albuquerque needs to recognize that they need to put pressure on their department to solve these cases. An 18-year-old girl is a citizen. She was killed. And we need to know who did that. It doesn't matter if it's 22 years old or 22 weeks old. Cases should be solved.
I'm sure that you have already read it, the manuscript that has a working title of
the Tally Keeper?
Yes.
That's Lois's book that she's working on, yes.
Right. It's a very powerful book. In fact, Lois and Don are going to be joining us next week on the program, and it's going to be interesting to, you know, hear mother and father give their description of events.
That's great, Simon.
Oh, can't wait. Well, no. I could wait. It's a program I really don't want to do. I didn't want to do this program. But there is no reason why Caitlin Arquette is dead. No reason at all. You know, she should be enjoying life. I don't know what to tell you. Pat, there's a couple of other subjects that I do want to touch on this afternoon. I want to thank you for participating, and please feel free to stay on the line and jump in if you want to. We always like a new voice. Manny, I'm going to pick on you. Tell us about Lawrence King.
Well, I guess though, if you don't see it on the national news, the jury deadlocked on Lawrence King, convicting him, believe it or not, of second-degree murder. And it raised a serious but interesting question in California. What do you do when you've got a child, 14 years old, who commits a murder, and are members of a jury willing to pull the trigger, so to speak, on the death penalty? And that's really what this case is about, because after listening to what some of them had to say, I was not surprised to hear them express reticence about putting a child into the death penalty situation. And that probably saved them. And, of course, that was one of the issues that the prosecution was pushing so well. Defense. So at the end of the day, that's a big issue. When you murder is murder, and at what point do you consider murder so serious that you take a teenager and put him in jail or have him executed? I happen to, by the way, stand for the position that perhaps if they executed him and made a big point of it and put his photo up in every school, maybe people stopped carrying guns to school. Nothing else seems to have worked.
Okay, just to recap for our listeners, here's the deal. Lawrence King was gay, very gay apparently, and one day he goes to school, sits in class, and his murderer sits right behind him, pulls out a gun, shoots him in the back of the head. Lawrence King falls on the floor. Murderer shoots him a second time. Clear case. I mean, it's obvious. There's loads of witnesses. There's no doubt about the murder weapon, method of the murder, or who the murderer was. How can you have a deadlock case? But it's the gay defense, isn't it?
I don't think so as much in this case. Part of it is the defense was relying on the gay defense, but it seemed to me the jury, from a little I've read and they've been willing to comment, it really revolves around the issue that none of them have the courage to pull the trigger on sending a child that age to the death penalty, because they felt that once, if he was convicted, it would end up getting the death penalty. And I don't know. And by the way, that's an argument around the world. A lot of countries criticize the United States for trying youth and the rest of them. They also criticize us for the death penalty and the length of time that people are incarcerated in this country. Because I believe England's down to just 10 years now, right? Isn't it, Simon? For murder?
And, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so you know, you take a look at a kid who's now 17, and under second-degree murder, more than likely he'd be out by his mid-20s. And that worries me, too, because this kid, to me, is a career criminal now. There's no way this child can be rehabilitated. He's not a child. He's an adult right now, and he can't be rehabilitated, certainly after going to what we all call crime school. If you're going to send a child to jail for that period of time, or he's not going to come back anything else but a polished criminal. So the benefits of having this child supposedly try to rehabilitate him in an overcrowded jail system in California, which is already purging prisoners because they don't even have room for him, then you tell me this could be back out in the streets because they don't have room for jail, and some psychologist or some panel will go, oh, well, he's no longer a danger to society. He's now older, and then much like everything else, within a few months he'll kill somebody, commit a crime, and because he can't get a job anymore because he's basically branded for life, and he's just going to become another criminal statistic. And I think that in this respect, American juries have to really suck it up and start looking at what's affecting this entire country. And we're almost back into the old West where people are hung from tree stumps because nobody had the time to wait for a judge or to let them buy them their way out of a crime. I don't know if anyone feels any differently.
I think I want to ask Pat if she has any thoughts on this, because it's a case that she's probably never heard of, and I'm sure she's just sat here going, huh?
Well, sad to say that it happens here too, and I am familiar with those cases, and I have to say that I don't know if I teach a class about investigation, and we always end up getting to talk about the laws and what are the death penalty cases, and so our class discusses this. I don't think I could sit on a death penalty case. I don't think I am smart enough, unbiased enough, and informed enough, or maybe too informed to know that the facts that we're getting may not be all the facts, although the case you just said sounds pretty cut and dried. I don't think I could sentence someone to death. Now, and yet the only people who should be able to do that, in my opinion, are the victims' families. They should be the ones to decide that. Now, I know that's not criminal justice system, but they're the only ones with the right to decide that the death, not me. I've made mistakes in investigations. What if I make a mistake and someone is dead? However, there are cases that are so heinous and the circumstances so clear-cut, and your first immediate reaction is get rid of this human, this person from the human race. That's an emotional thing. I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about the death penalty. But it should not go on for years. If it's not going to be swift and sure, then it is not a deterrent. Then it becomes a political process, and that shouldn't be. It should be a deterrent to crime. That's the only thing it should be for.
Yeah, I agree. And by the way, that's something we should all get to one day, is the death penalty and the delays. And because I believe that if it were swift, it would have some meaning. But when it's delayed,
yes,
and then done in some humane fashion, then what good is it as a deterrent? Sometimes I feel, Pat, that putting somebody in a cell block, in a cell that we know is about 5 foot by 6, and then putting them in isolation, which is what happens with most first-degree murderers for the rest of their life, is more painful for them than it is to basically get the death penalty. I know I would prefer that.
I go the full gamut. I do understand all of that, but I'm not sure. Thank God, the three times in my career in law enforcement when I had to pull my service weapon, the whole time I was praying, please, God, don't make me have to shoot. I would have, if it was necessary, to save someone else's life. I'm not sure I would have done it to save mine, but I knew I could do it. So I'm not the best person on death penalty. However, putting people, and then to say, well, we're going to give the death by injection because that's more humane, and then we can't give him or her medication to put her out or him out to get the needle because that's cruel and inhuman. And we are so politically correct that nothing makes any sense anymore.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Dave, any comments?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's so many different complex issues going on. I mean, this, you know, the thing that I think is funny would be if the guy gets sent away and then he gets to know Big Bubba, you know, in a way that he didn't want to meet Big Bubba. I mean, he's going to come out of that jail one day because he's a minor or whatever, and he's going to be one screwed up in the head dude, you know, because he killed somebody for being gay. And he might be forced to be that way in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I can't see that as a deterrent for him to do it again. He's going to come out more evil than he was when he went in.
Many, it was a mistrial. Will they go again?
Oh, I'm sure they will. There was an article in the LA Times saying how difficult it'll be for them. My experiences are completely different. My experiences is the police's rate, the prosecutor's rate on retrials is significantly higher than the first time around for a couple of reasons. One, they know what they did right or wrong and they correct themselves. Mm-hmm. Two, they're more careful about picking a jury. And the simple fact is anything you do twice in terms of prosecution, you got to do better. So, and I'm not so certain that Pat doesn't agree with that same view also. Pat, in your experiences, have you seen the same thing?
I would agree. And again, let me go back to saying that I want to trust that in general, while our criminal justice system is broken, it is not entirely corrupt, and that we can trust that there are good decisions being made. There are good actions, good investigations. I choose to believe that. I want to hope to believe that. And yes, when you know what mistakes you made in the first case, then you can do better. There's so many interesting things, like the word penitentiary. The penitentiary is a place where people were sent to be penitent, which means to think about what they did, and then when they thought about it long enough, they would then know they did wrong and come out and be good citizens. They weren't allowed to do work in a penitentiary because doing work or having a job in prison took away from the penitent position. I like the interesting aspects about words. So we have prisons, we have houses of the correction, we have detention centers, penitentiaries, all from a political or philosophical point of view, why we put people somewhere and what was the goal we were hoping to achieve. And unfortunately, we're not achieving any of the goals.
Okay.
And I'd like to come back to something quickly to slip by. Your comments about pulling your weapon, and a lot of people will take that differently, but I always think of a comment my older brother made to me after World War II. He served on Iwo Jima, and I once asked him about bravery, because he was basically stuck on the shore for 4 or 5 days, couldn't move, and it was a radio operator, and it was the worst experience of his life. Something affected him the rest of his life. And he said this to me about courage. He said, if you're not afraid, you're a fool. And if you're not afraid of what you're doing and you look at it any differently, then you're a killer, and you don't want to be either one
mm-hmm.
of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that unless anyone who pulls his weapon it feels that way, I think they're dangerous to society. You have to be an effective police person. You have to not want to pull that weapon. And if you do want to pull it, then you're going to have more police-involved shootings. And I think you probably agree with that.
I absolutely do agree with that. And my initial training was at the Philadelphia Police Department. Frank Rizzo was my commissioner of police. And I believe that it was from his examples that I learned the integrity of my job that I believe I have. I went into burning buildings, but he was there in front going into the same burning buildings. You only were permitted to shoot if lethal force was required. You could not fire warning shots. You could not shoot to wound. You had to evaluate the situation, and there were very few questionable shootings, at least in my recollection in the Philadelphia Police Department. But the point, the end point I'm trying to make is that there are many people who would have told you then that the Philadelphia Police Department was a corrupt department. And yet,
yeah.
I felt if I was being motivated to be pure, and now I'm beginning to sound like truth, justice, in the American way, but I felt I was called to a higher standard. I don't think a department can call you to a higher standard if that department is corrupt.
Well, that's funny because Rizzo had such an unusual reputation that he exposed himself to a lot of that, but he achieved a lot that was very, very good also.
And so we say about the Albuquerque Police Department or some of these other departments, is it the department is corrupt or is it the individual officers? I am not smart enough to figure that out yet. But I know you riding with somebody and you trust them with your life many nights. And then they say, oh, we're not going to take this route tonight. We're going to go another route. You never think that they may be doing something wrong. And you go along with it. And guess what? You have now been corrupted.
Sure.
And that's how easy it can happen.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think our listeners know that our feelings about individual actions of some policemen are not intended as an indictment of others. It's just the actions of individuals that we challenge frequently on this show. And I don't know there's anyone with a stronger track record on law and order than our listeners. So anyone who thinks that we may have in some way taken a position, we take whatever we say in regard to police departments, and we say it reluctantly. And I think
and
that a member of our panel agrees.
And who should be the ones speaking out strongly is the police department and members of the police department. This wall that of protection really is a disservice to themselves. If you see an officer doing wrong, speak up. I know the public gives police a hard time. But police give me a hard time now as a private investigator. They see me as less than them, and I understand some of that. But they should be speaking out about this, and this is why on Caitlin's case I have taken it to APD every time I got new information. Here, solve this so that you can get rid of this stain. But whoever or whatever is in front of this is too strong.
On the Caitlin case, there's a DVD. In some ways, it's rather like watching John Grissom's The Pelican Brief. It hasn't been published. I asked Lois and Don why, and their response was, "We're scared for Pat."
Oh, I would hope they are not putting that out because of me. It has been said to me, we're surprised you're still alive. I can't operate that way. And I feel like my best protection is I have no secret information. Everything I have learned is public. It has been print. There's no reason to get rid of me because you're not going to protect yourself. However, I appreciate their caring, and if that is why they're not putting this DVD out, they need to put it out.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock here. We're running out of time, but there's one more case that we have to talk about. It's the Stupidity of the Week case. Or Stupidity of the Century case, Casey Anthony. My wife has been mysteriously quiet. What happened this week?
Oh, now you've got me at a total blank. I wasn't expecting you to question me.
Okay, we'll just scoot over Jan, and we'll go to Dave. Dave, you were in the courtroom, I understand, for what has to be one of the most boring hearings ever known. Oh, it was so boring, Dave's gone to sleep.
You there? You there, it is.
Yeah.
I had I put my mute button on because I had to go out and talk to somebody, so... Here I am talking to you now, and I was like, nowhere, man. Anyway, yeah, I was there. I got there at 10, just before 10, and I walked into the courtroom, and all this stuff is going on already. I said, no, I know it was 10 o'clock. But then it turned out, it didn't take me long to figure out that there were other cases from the morning docket. So Casey's case didn't come up until about almost 10 minutes to 11. And I'll tell you, the prior cases were a lot more interesting than than Casey's motion. So it was that was more entertainment to me. Once we got into what's her name, Linda Drain Burdick, and Mason, it kind of got really boring, and the wooden chair or seats, like, they're like church pews, got really uncomfortable. So when we went to lunch, I decided to go home and watch it, and I did that. I didn't come back into the courtroom. What I see, though, is what Mason's trying to do. He's really trying to take an ice pick and break some of that money away from the prosecution, you know, the law enforcement. Like, for example, they bought a book, okay? Well, they bought the prosecutor, I think it was, or police, I don't remember who it was, bought a book from eBay, and they added that to the cost. But the thing is, I mean, a book is something that's very tangible. So once you're done reading it, you can give it to somebody else to read, and so on and so on. So it's not like something you pay someone to come and testify at the trial. You have to pay for their airfare, you have to pay for their time, just like any other job. But a book, I don't know. There's a lot of little issues I think the defense is going to go nitpicking.
Okay, the hearing itself was about apportioning costs for the investigation. Am I right?
Yeah, it's like $517,000.
Okay. Jen, speak.
517,000.
What, Phil, can someone tell me what the final amount was? Not what was approved.
517,000, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it is.
All right, Manny, I know the answer to this, but I'd like to hear it from someone that's smarter than I am.
And you're asking the wrong guy. Jan, you can answer this one because I know you're smarter than both of us, okay?
Boy, that shut everybody up, didn't it?
But all joking aside, you know, costs are an argument in civil cases as well. It is one of the ugly little untalked about secrets that after every case, everybody fights like cats and dogs to see who's responsible for paying what. And I want to tell you, I find it one of the most upsetting areas in the practice of law. The things that people argue about, the nickel and diming. Well, the prosecution, every dime they can attach to her goes off their budget in terms of what they spent in it. And in a case where they lost, this number becomes particularly embarrassing to them. So they're concerned that every little number that comes out and every little thing that happens is a major embarrassment to them. So that's what this is about. And in the end, the numbers don't mean very much.
Right. Now, you know, I'm not a lawyer. If someone slapped me with, you know, $500,000 worth of stuff, you know, I'd just turn around and say, well, I didn't ask you to do this, and I was found not guilty.
Well, that's a big issue.
Right. So,
But you know what it is. I mean, the problem is that she was convicted of lying to law enforcement on four separate charges, and that's when she was initially investigated. For example, she wasn't under arrest for murder, so she put the police on the wrong path.
But yeah,
you know,
but
they look
is,
for a living Kaylee, you know, an abducted Kaylee.
Well, Dave, let me ask you this question. The issue is, you know what she was convicted of, so how much of those costs relate specifically to what she was convicted of? That's the issue, is, you know.
Well, they were all lying to law enforcement.
No, they weren't.
You
they prosecuted her for first-degree murder.
No. She was not found guilty. She was found guilty only of lying to officers four times. Those are four separate charges.
Yes, but...
And so, wait a minute. What they're saying is that they want the money from July 15th, when Casey started the lie, okay, through December 11th is what the defense said, And then Linda Drain Berta came back and said, well, wait a minute now. We didn't even know whose remains they were until the 90s. So technically, if you want to get, ugly here, we can go all the way to the 19th. And, and she did. She lied right from the start.
Okay. But the point is, at what point did she stop being on the nut to pay?
Well, wait a minute, Simon. There's a bigger question. Why should this decided over a case in which they lie be able to try an issue like that off of declarations that favor the prosecution and make a decision? And I think it's a question of due process rights. In many instances, those items are sent to another judge to decide because of potential prejudice. And I don't think this is the judge who decided it. He really isn't. That's an issue, too.
He is. Well, the appellate court already decided that Judge Perry is there to stay.
Well, I know,
that's already done.
Yes, but I'm saying to you, this is a hybrid issue that you see so rarely in court. All of you are somewhat surprised by it, and it doesn't happen very often. And this is maybe a case of first impression. I know of no other case where someone has been found not guilty of a crime and found guilty of a lesser offense where they've been able to, it's called taxing costs. And I've never seen an instance where this type of taxing of costs has been permitted. So, yeah.
I agree with you. I've never seen it before either. So that is kind of, but now my understanding is that it's not unusual that you don't hear about it. You maybe as an attorney, but common people like me, we don't normally hear about it because we don't follow any other specific cases for the most part. So if you got somebody that robbed the bank during the investigation, the guy was found guilty, then the police submit a bill and the guy's got to pay it. Well, that's something that we don't hear of every day. That's all.
Well, but
that's
not
going on.
Here's the real easy way of looking at it. Someone walks around my house and says, there's a leaky roof. He climbs up on my roof and hammers down a couple of tiles and then knocks on my door and gives me $1,000 bill. Hey, you owe me $1,000 for fixing your roof. And I go, but I didn't ask you to fix my roof. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Well, the difference, I think, with that, Simon, is that it's different. I mean, it's totally different when it comes to law enforcement and investigations. It's not like a cop just randomly came over to your house and got up on your roof, or a cop looked in your window and saw that you were doing something illegal and arrested you for it. I mean, this is a whole different ball game here. This is where, this is what the police do for a living. They investigate. And when there's a missing child, they can't sit there and say, well, we're not going to do it because we're never going to be reimbursed for it. I mean, not that they should be reimbursed necessarily. I'm not going one way or the other on what I'm talking about now, what I'm saying now. But it's not like they have any, it's not like the guy that goes on your roof and nails down. Because the police don't operate that way. I mean, they're paid to do what they do.
Okay. There was another aspect in the idiot case of the century that has me just as annoyed. She's on probation, and the terms of the probation are that she either has to get a job or be in school. And as I understood it, she was going to be taking some online classes, hopefully not concerning babysitting. Jen, you know a little bit.
Well, she reported to her probation officer on the 1st. And they did say that she was supposed to be taking the online courses to begin with to get her GED first. As of the 1st, she hadn't even signed up for anything. She was still clearly unemployed, no money, hadn't made a dime since the time she got out of jail. But they said that all they were going to do was encourage her to try to find employment. What's up with that? I mean, if the terms of her probation is that she has to prove where she is showing, looking for employment, or go to school, and yet she hasn't even bothered to sign up for the online classes, how can they let her get away with that?
Well, I think what they've said, though, I mean, really, if I can just say this, I think what I've read so far is that they are giving her some leeway because of the nature of the beast, so to speak.
But she shouldn't get it, though. Why should she get it? Would I get
it?
Well,
I would say if somebody broke into robbed the bank, and then a month later they're diagnosed with rectal cancer, okay? And I'm just using that, you know, but you know, then they're in the hospital, then they're confined to their home, you know, taking medication and stuff. But they were caught. Now, would they go to jail? Would they sit there? And would the probation officer allow her, or parole, or whatever it is, officer, allow them, that person, to you know, certain leeways because of the nature of their sickness? Stop their illness.
She's not sick.
I mean, I think
though,
they can bend the rules.
Well,
no, she is sick.
No, not that way. No, she claimed that she was sane as can be when she was in court. They claimed that there was nothing wrong with her.
Well, my point
now,
is so much what it is, it's that there are ways to bend the rules. That's all I'm trying to say here. That was one extreme.
Well, she shouldn't get the privileges.
Let's come back to where we started with several weeks ago. This probation is the stupidest thing I've seen to practice law for a long time for the reasons that we're now discussing. And guess what? Those reasons will be there tomorrow. They'll be there the next day. And as I said, this case is the gift that keeps on giving, because guess what? The folly of that is going to keep showing up with every single move. Jan's going to go, well, why did they do this? Why did they do that? And what they did is created a situation that they can't properly handle and monitor, and have basically done something stupid. And at the end of the day, this particular form of probation is going to be absolutely an embarrassment to them. And it already is, frankly.
Okay, I have to ask Pat, because I think she's still on the line.
I'm here.
Right. You teach some courses. Do you have room for one more student?
I would love all of you to come and be a guest panel.
Not us. we're talking about Casey Anthony.
Well, that's a whole. I was fascinated. The gentleman mentioned a boring aspect. I was fascinated with the process. I wanted to see every minute, because there was so much to learn in every minute. That was a fascinating case, and I'm not even sure how I feel about the whole thing, but I want to learn from it. And what do we learn from that? Did we charge her incorrectly? I don't know what the answer is. And yes, why the probation is confusing, and she shouldn't get special treatment, and yet she does get special treatment. And why do offenders get special treatment and victims don't? It's a whole can of worms.
Well, there's one of the can of worms is, consider this: had she been tried for just lying to the police, they could not tax her all these other costs. And at the end of the day, you'd have a completely different result, one of which is she would have made bail. So had she made bail, you would have had a completely different result, because you would have had something completely different to factor. And it's not that I'm supporting her or agree with her. It's just that I saw very quickly that any effort to turn this into any logical form a probation simply cannot work within this scenario. And what you're seeing is the practical aspects of a failed philosophical move by the courts. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a failed decision. And if anyone wants to wonder why it's failed, just look at what's going on now.
Jen has me on probation.
All the time.
You know, this is not one word by any of us. We're all being very careful, Jan. But all joking aside, Jan, I would like to see her punished correctly for her crimes. And sooner or later, she will be in some form or another. But imposing this form of probation on her that doesn't work, that's compromised by its very nature, I don't think it's productive either. So all they did was serve to piss off everybody watching this case by creating an atmosphere that makes this basic probation fail. So here we are, we're hardly a week or two into it, and they're already failing. And that's been my point since day one. They've just created an opportunity for themselves to fail and look even worse. So that's my last thought on it.
Jen, are you going to rant at us?
There is something else I'd like to say about all of it. I mean, not just the probation or anything like that. If the courts would just take this woman and forbid her to draw a dime off anything to do with this baby's death, then all of these lawsuits and all that would be unnecessary, because this is why people are doing it. They're doing it to keep her from keeping any money that she makes out of this. That is why everybody is trying, other than the fact that some of them are, all they see is dollar signs in their eyes. That would just solve everything if they just forbid anybody to make, because of all the controversies, if no other reason. And that includes the grandparents, too, that claim that they want it just for the donation for their fund, that everybody knows that they're getting in their pocket no matter what Dr. Phil says.
Me, I prefer Doctor Who over Doctor Phil. I mean,
so
Doctor
do
Who
I.
saves the world.
Yeah. Doctor Phil is, shall we say, is only famous and popular in the Midwest. In Beverly Hills and Los Angeles, he's the village of Joe. So, I wouldn't take him too seriously. But a comment about this. California has passed a law that forbids people to profit from this type of situation. I'm shocked Florida doesn't have a similar law that prevents profiteering. Except for the parents and the grandparents, I don't think you can include them in the law. But basically, in California, there would be no discussion. If any money that she earned from it would go to the victim.
It should. Yeah, but the victim is no longer with us.
All right. We're just about flat out of time. So I want to go once around the table. We lost Cobra somewhere along the way, but I'm used to that. He needs to buy himself a new phone. What I want to do is get everyone's last thoughts. Pat, I want to start with you. You were our special guest this week. I do hope that we didn't bore you too much. I'd like to know, what your thoughts are about the Caitlin Arquette case, and also these other cases that we've talked about.
You don't have enough time for me to go where I would want to go. I want to say thank you for the gracious reception I've been given, for the time that I've been given, and your willingness to listen to information on a 20-year-old case, and just know that it's representative of all the families who don't have answers to their questions. Not only do they have the loss of their loved one, but they have the loss of information. And if I can in any way help by presenting what I know, I'm honored to do so, and thank you for having me. And you sound like an interesting group.
Eclectic. I think eclectic.
Yes.
Manny.
Well, my last thoughts were is that I hope this show is helping the people that listen understand a wider spectrum of information on our justice system, because the more they listen is the more they can help us reform it and make it more effective, because really all of our goals are to reform and make this system far more effective. Simon and I do this during the week in the area of food, and in recent months we've seen it change and alter how people perceive and buy in food and alter issues that have to do with human health. And it's our hope that we're going to achieve much the same here. So listen, learn, try to get something out of what we're saying, and if you don't, well, listen anyway. And I'd like to thank Pat, because, Pat, if we haven't permanently scarred you, we hope you come back.
Thank you.
And Dave?
He's kind of breaking up because he got disconnected.
Uh-oh. Okay, well, we'll...
I don't know, you might can hear him. Dave, are you there?
But I am.
Dave.
I'm waiting patiently.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, a little bit.
Dave, your parting thoughts for us today.
Okay, I just want to make sure that you can hear me, because I had a terrible problem phone here for a while. But, I think it's a really interesting show today. I think that this Caitlin case is something that we should be able to pursue and really look into. I think it's one of those rare opportunities, that come along that you just want to look into. I was sold on it as soon as I started reading what you emailed me, Simon.
And Jan.
Okay, I'll apologize for my outburst. But I do get very, very frustrated with this case that I was following all those years. And I do hope that they do find something out about Caitlin's murder. I call it murder. And I do hope that they can come and get some justice with that, too.
This is Simon.
Simon.
Oh, you're not...
Simon.
That's a little bit Denny.
Simon.
Oh, Denny.
He forgot
Denny.
You, Denny.
Denny. You're so quiet.
I've been waiting patiently. I just wanted to, a couple of quick comments before we go. I wanted to say about the death penalty. I agree with, I think, what Manny and Pat said. It's got to be swift to be of any value. And I got a lot more comments. Maybe sometime we'll do a show or a segment on that, because there's a lot there. The other thing, real quickly, it's been a while since the big acquittal of Casey Anthony. What's her interview worth today? At first it was going to be Mega Millions. Where are we at now?
About $5.
A bad McDonald's hamburger.
Yeah, and by the end of this week, it'll be down to a Big Mac and a regular Coke. Yeah, they won't even be able to supersize it.
And it's back to my earlier comment, Simon. She can't tell the truth. She can't pass a lie detector test, so no one's willing to touch her. So to preserve her fake plea of I didn't do it, she's been forced now to do absolutely no interviews, because if not, the whole world's going to know what we all suspect, that she did it.
Oh, say it's not so.
Oh, well.
Yeah, it's so, Simon.
I'm in shock. Okay, I need to wrap this program up. I want to thank everyone for taking part, and I want to thank our listeners, and I have a sneaking hunch that the Sunday Afternoon Murder Club will be back next Sunday. And if you just can't get enough of us, you can listen to Manny and I and Manny's wife Ashley rail on the food industry and politics on Thursdays at high noon Eastern Time. Till then, goodbye.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.